Riverhead Books presents Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, a podcast with Marlon James and Jake Morrissey.
There is something very rich in tearing a book apart.
I don't want to spend my eyeballs on these 300 pages.
You really don't have to read any novel, except maybe Moby Dick.
I'm stunned hearing you say that.
The first book I got was Journal of a Plague Year.
The feel-good book of the pandemic, ladies and gentlemen.
I know. I'm a reverse size queen when it comes to literature, I guess.
Okay, I love this more and more.
Hi, listeners out there. I'm Marlon James, which means the other person must be Jake Morrissey.
That's me.
And, you know, we're still here and the dead people are still dead. And we're going to talk about them. Talk about, you know, the long deceased, the recently deceased. That sounds really, really morbid. We're really not talking about the authors. We're really talking about their works, which is particularly important, I think, for this episode, the whole idea of focusing on the work more so than the author. And why would that be, Jake?
Because we want to talk about good books by terrible people.
Mm-hmm.
So my question to you is, Marlon James, What do you think of when I say that? How terrible are we talking?
That, you know, it's so much of this is up for grabs, including the whole definition of terrible. Are these people terrible, or they did terrible things, or do they have, you know, a terrible worldview, or just something about them that's really unsavory, or just makes them kind of an asshole? And I think that depends. Sometimes it's somebody who is racist, or it could have been somebody who was, you know, an abuser. And so on. So the realm of what exactly comes terrible is so big that I can bet two terrible authors would be horrified that they're in the same list.
Would they both admit that they were terrible, or is part of being terrible admitting that you're not terrible or claiming you're not terrible?
I think so. You know, there's an article that came out, I can't remember where, and it was talking about, are we at the end of the sexually predatory, inappropriate literary guy? And how we gave a huge pass to this for a while. And how also, and I hope we talk about this in this episode, the whole idea that it's the art, not the artist, which I've always thought that was as simplistic as the sort of throwing away the baby with the bathwater. My problem with both arguments is that they're both simplistic. You know, okay. It's saying that we should follow the art and not the artist is implying that aspects of the artist's persona doesn't show up in the work.
Well, also, does memory play a part in all this? I mean, you walk through the streets of Rome, for example, and you see these paintings by, say, Caravaggio, who actually murdered people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not the greatest person on the planet. Wasn't the greatest person in Baroque Rome. On the other hand, created some amazing art. Is that, do we care? In other words, does the statute of limitations on being a terrible person, if you're a writer, stop after a certain period of time? Is the bad behavior of your fave and mine, Charles Dickens, forgiven 180 years later because of the great stuff that he has written that you and I have both enjoyed and tell people to read?
I wonder if part of the problem is the idea that we should reconcile them in the first place. That if it's, because I remember my example of my views on this evolving. You brought up Charles Dickens, and I wrote an article back in 2015 about Dickens and about what do we do with these authors.
Mm-hmm.
And even before that, I wrote a blog called The Bigots on My Bookshelf, when I was talking about how I was really laying into Flannery O'Connor until I saw Knut Hamsun on my shelf.
Interesting.
He was such a Nazi, he gave his Nobel Prize to Goebbels.
Okay, so are you saying that he's worse than Flannery O'Connor?
No, I'm saying that there is merit to the kind of slippery slope argument about if we're going to start going after people for the bad things they do, we might end up with a much shorter list. And I'll add to that, as a black person, as a person of color, this is shit I have to deal with all the time.
Totally.
You know, many of them are problematic in ways in which other people may not have to, never had to consider. I think a lot of male readers never have to consider a sexist author, or a white reader have to consider necessarily, a racist writer. But what I said, the second time, so it's three times I tackled this. The first one was about the bigots on my bookshelf and how I can't reconcile it. Mm-hmm. The second time I wrote about it, it was mostly about Dickens. And as a Jamaican, I have some personal issues with Dickens, because one of the worst violations of human rights that have ever happened in Jamaica, when the authorities pretty much murdered nearly 500 people just for basically protesting for their rights. Dickens supported it.
He supported the...
The brutal crackdown, even though that was a final straw event for colonial Britain to go, right. This was too far. It's not far enough. So, and I said in that article, maybe when you engage with a problematic, and I hate that word, a problematic person's work, you're engaging with their best self.
Okay, so if you say that, if you say, okay, Charles Dickens, author of, fill in a novel title here, love the work, problematic, do you draw the line in a different place than I do?
I wonder, because what I was going to say after that is that then I remember confronting that issue again. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think that was good enough either. Because I think when you read and you reread, when you reread Flannery O'Connor, you start to see the limitations in her worldview. And one of the things that makes her worldview limiting is racism.
Yes.
It's that racism is not just, bigotry and ignorance. It's also a kind of backwardness.
Yes.
And I think that if you read it deep enough, you see that. There is that. I think we excuse it as a sort of extreme, a sort of a Catholicism,
Yes.
In the work.
Yes. Now, growing up, as a good Catholic boy, she was always portrayed as an important Catholic writer, all capitals. And as you read her, you're starting to think, okay, you may think that. She's also a Southern racist.
Mm-hmm.
And, even as a white boy from New England who did not have that kind of experience dealing with people like her growing up next door to me, it was very clear. So I kept sort of looking around thinking, am I the only one who is having this reaction to this writer? And, we're at a point now where people are, I think, much more interested, or more interested than they used to be, the idea that you as a reader can choose who to read and not to read based on the writer's sort of where the writer comes from, how they behave, what they write about. Now, is that something that we all should be doing?
I think we're all doing it anyway. I think ultimately, not to jump to the end of this podcast, but ultimately, we judge these writers in the court of our private opinion. I think ultimately the last thing I want to do is tell people who they should and shouldn't read. And I think sometimes people think that's what's happening when we talk about, heaven forbid we bring in the dread word, the word canceling and so on. It's not a let's cancel Flannery O'Connor. And also if somebody says that, I think a lot of times they're meaning I'm canceling them in my personal view. You can read her if you want. I think that ultimately it's a tricky and painful set of decisions. And I think everybody, and I know I do, will have a complicated bookshelf where, okay, I can keep that, but I won't have that. Or maybe that's going too far, or you went too far here. If Flannery O'Connor's, racism is very much a part of an upbringing that could not have been any better, do I judge that on the same level of what's her name, who wrote Mists of Avalon, where there are allegations that she sexually molested her child?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
As I said, alleged. Don't come sue us, people. But alleged to the point where it became sort of a common knowledge. Like, what do you do with that? That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Terrible has levels.
Well, then you talk about somebody like Roald Dahl. who, you know, beloved author of books like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, essentially an unrepentant anti-Semite. And, you know, was comfortable talking about his views on, you know, Jewishness as a grown-up, I mean, you know, in public. So it wasn't, it was some sort of secret thing. And even in the sort of early drafts of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the Oompa Loompas were, in fact, black pygmies.
Yeah.
Now, in one of the early iterations, too, of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Charlie was a black kid. And his editor convinced him to change that. So my point in bringing up Roald Dahl is that I'm sure nobody reading Charlie and the Chocolate Factory said, oh my gosh, I can't read this because Roald Dahl is was an anti-Semite. But is that the right attitude to take? Is that what we should be saying? Is that what we should be sort of setting aside and saying, you know what, we're not gonna talk about this or read this book or this author again?
I wonder. I think there may be two answers to that. One, I think we're gonna have to come to terms with the idea that we're gonna have to recognize art and recognize that the artists who made them are not always up to our moral ethical standards. But I also think we should realize we also have the freedom of choice. You know, I think my final, this is something like an arc. The third time I engaged that topic, I remember saying, you know what, I'm going to give these people, I'm giving them my indifference. If I want to read Knute Hamsun, I'll read him. If I don't want to read him, I won't read him. What I won't give him is a moral crisis. Because why am I having a moral crisis over somebody who didn't have a moral crisis over me? Okay. So just once, I want to hear Flannery O'Connor really struggle with her racism. Just once, I want to hear Jack London had one moment when he realized that maybe you should look at people with a more complicated lens, that people are now insisting that that I look at them with. And I said, so no, what I think I'm tired of is the hand-wringing over whether we should read these people or not. I think it's perfectly fine to never read Hemingway again. I think it's also fine if you find something out of him. I'm just saying, as a person of color, reading people who have routinely locked people like me out of the world they're writing, and locked people out of me out of the world of people they consider even as a reader, is normal. So, like, you know, would I read problematic people? I'm like, welcome to my high school lit class.
Well, that was exactly what I was going to say, is it's one thing for you and I to sit here and decide who we're going to read. Pull off the shelf, you know, if I mean, God forbid I should ever do this. If I want to read Gone with the Wind again, I don't. But if I want to read Gone with the Wind again, I can do it in the privacy of my home.
Yeah.
If you're sitting in a high school classroom or a college classroom, and somebody says, "All right, we're going to read, you know, Flannery O'Connor," and talk about it, and it's almost as if you have no choice, or if the parameters are chosen for you, is the problem the larger systemic, you know, frame of education?
Think about it, though. Of course, it's a problem. And think of something about high school that has spilled over into adult literary criticism, and it's still spilled over now, even in how we talk about books. And we learned this in high school, that your default position must always be defend the author.
What do you mean? How do you mean, like?
Meaning that you should always come from the point of view that if this book is in your hand, it's worthy. This is a great piece of work. You just haven't had the tools yet to know how to appreciate it. So get there. And I'm not totally knocking that. But I also think there is something very rich in tearing a book apart.
Totally.
You know, I remember when I was last time I taught lit, my students were actually surprised that I came out attacking two of the books I was teaching. I was like, this is reading a book too.
Exactly.
This is like, this part is unacceptable, or this part is such and such. I remember one state saying, this part of a book is a narrative dirty trick. Let me show you what the person did. You know, they I'm not going to discuss the whole thing, what the narrative dirty trick is, because it's going to be, we'll Google it, and then I'll start another fight on Facebook or Twitter. But the my problem with this sort of defend the work instead and forget the author is that even that becomes simplistic. Why can't we interrogate the work? I actually think interrogating the racism in a Jack London story can be a really fruitful class. I think that you know, showing the ways in which, say, take a story that people routinely bring out to defend Flannery O'Connor. Everything that rises must converge.
Yes,
it's always the one people trot out. What about? But I'm saying, but are those black characters, or is that just a projection of her fear and desire that she reacted to? You know, Jane Smiley brought this up about Heart of Darkness. Again, and I bring it up all the time with these characters. Are you sure, you know, we can make a blanket statement, 99.999% any white post-war writer wrote about women.
Yeah. Okay, if you can find, I'm ready to go to 100%. If you can find, yeah. If you can find one who hasn't.
I'm like trying to, you know, I'm zipping through my Hemingways, my Millers, my son. I'm like, have they ever written one real woman?
Right. Correct.
I don't think they have.
Right.
You know, but it's what you have, particularly with the post-war writers, is a complete projection of fear and desire. Sometimes at the same time.
Right.
Right. That they reacted to, and I think that these books can still be rich in the sense that let's interrogate them deeply. I think the sort of defend the book, defend the author is also a superficial way of looking at what could be a useful text. I think historians get a lot of, certainly some sort of perspective in going back into historical texts and picking out, oh, here's the bias. It's okay. Like, If your only version of Troy is from Herodotus, then at some point you're going to have to go, this dude is a Greek.
Well, to your point about defend the book, defend the author, does that come from your kind of classical or classically formed British education, British
oh,
public
school? Absolutely.
Because I came from a public school in the middle of New England where the goal was, you need to read these books and figure out what you think about it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like here is what you think. So, I mean, the first time I read like The Great Gatsby, I was too young for it, clearly, because the piece I wrote had nothing to do with the car crash and like, you know, running over a daisy Myrtle. It was sort of like talking about the conflict between Gatsby and Tom Buchanan. And the teacher was like, Jake, this is not about two boys arguing over a woman. This is about, you know, something very different. Anyway, my point in all this is that what you're really talking about is giving people the right or permission to decide what they think about the books they read and be willing to say, this is not good for reasons that have to do with the words on the page or for the reasons that having to do with the person who wrote it.
I find that I'm as uncomfortable assuming that the horrible aspects of a person's character shows up in their work as I am dismissing it. I think H.P. Lovecraft is a racist, and you can take the that away from the work, of course. There are tons of black writers in fantasy and horror who are hugely influenced by Lovecraft. But at the same time, the fact that he was a racist and the fact that he didn't give a lot of people humanity meant that his dialogue is atrocious.
Okay.
His dialogue is horrible. His projection of other people is horrible, and that it stems from, among other things, that, you know, that racism. I'm not saying you have to become a better person, but you have to be careful that these flaws in your nature are some of the things that stop you from actually identifying with or bringing humanity to your characters. It certainly stopped a lot of the post-war writers from writing a solid woman.
Well, is there any post-war writer who has written a solid woman, in your opinion?
I'm trying to think if Robert Stone did it. Probably. Maybe in Beer and His Daughter. I can't remember which story exactly. Maybe Robert Stone. Again, it's And we're all over the place because we started out the truly terrible. And some of these writers aren't truly atrocious human beings. And then I have to watch it because I'm like, it's easy to see how that stymies somebody like Mailer. But at the same time, I like Burroughs, who literally shot a woman in the head and killed
her. Yes, yes, yes. And you know, Norman Mailer beat up his wife, I believe. And essentially kind of built a reputation of being, you know, a bad boy. And, you know, we as a culture bought it.
Yeah.
And
it's interesting when you see that evolve, because in the 90s, you didn't have the bad boy who thought, you know, the vagina must be tamed. You kind of end up with the whiny boy who's like, well, it's really about me.
Well, that might be getting a little too close to people who are still alive. So,
some of them are dead.
Well, I guess basically what you just said makes me wonder about the flip side of the same question, which is, are there sort of terrible books that good writers shouldn't have written? It's a slightly different question. But
well, yeah, I'm bless his memory, but Philip Roth probably shouldn't have written The Breast.
Okay.
That book is not going to age well.
No, that's true. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I mean, so you sit here and say, not you say, but I mean, the idea is like, all right, you would be a good person sitting to answer this question. Sitting in this chair, do you know you're writing a terrible book?
Yes. And I never made sure it never got published.
For which?
I have a whole drawer full of Rebound books. And usually if I get a novel to you, it's because the novel I wrote right before it I shelved.
Okay.
And before I wrote Book of Night Woman, I wrote a novel called Cock and Bull.
Wow. Wow.
Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that Will Self already has a novel called Cock and Bull. And
This is a part of you I never knew, Marlon. This is like...
Listen, I got to page 500 of it.
And then you said, enough?
No, then I think I called Colin McCann. And I was like, if I'm at page 500 in a book and I don't like anybody yet, should I stop? And I think he said, like, you need to step away from the laptop,
Marlon.
Because I thought I couldn't stop, but I did. It's not that I didn't like the characters. I didn't care, you know, about them. You know, I took a whole thing of bad books from people who should know better. You know, I am Charlotte Simmons. What the hell was that all about?
I don't know. I don't know Charlotte Simmons. I know the book, but I don't know why it was written.
I'm trying to figure out what is an octogenarian man doing in a college girl's panties. That's not correct.
And it's not a space that we want to spend a lot of time in talking about. Let's be honest.
Yeah. Even the essential creepiness. Let's not even get to the badness of the novel. The essential creepiness. It's like, you know, nobody wants Lolita goes to college.
No.
Unless Lolita is writing it.
Well, okay, I'm somebody who's not even interested in Lolita. I find the whole that whole matrix just like, you know what? I can get my creepy elsewhere. Thank you very much.
It's funny because you asked me to name my four or five favorite Nabokov. That does not enter.
Really? Because?
No. Because I don't think it's as good as Penin.
Okay.
For example. Penin, I went, holy shit, he has a sense of humor. I did not know.
He could make me laugh. Interesting. Well, because I mean, somebody like him. That's the thing is that the headline is for somebody like, for Lolita. It's like, oh yeah, you know, this is the one that's everybody sort of titillate about, and it came out at a time when it was anyway, and it became something he probably couldn't get away with. I mean, get around. My point is, like, you couldn't get around, and yet you're telling me, you did. Which I think is a credit to you because you're willing to. I did not. I'm not.
But I think, yeah. What annoys me about discussions about Lolita is everybody accusing the other person of narrowness. And I'm like, okay, so you're a defender of Lolita. You're not big enough to accept that he can read a book about a pedophile?
Right.
this whole "What Will Alita" is really about? I'm like, sweetie, I read the book too.
I don't want to spend my eyeballs on these 300 pages. I have, and I don't want to do it again. And that may be one of those things where we sort of say to people, you have, you know, you need to make the decision yourself about what books and authors you're willing to read and put up with deciding you don't like.
And I also think people should remember, you know, no author is owed a reader.
Oh, interesting.
I remember as a writer, you know, getting myself the hard lesson, you know, nobody's obligated to read your book.
True.
Nobody, there's absolutely nobody other than my family and friends who simply must read my book. And by the way, they haven't read my book. and when you realize, I think it's, I wonder sometimes if these arguments are trying to sort of diffuse the fact that the reader has a lot of power here. And when you tell people, you must read Lolita, no, you don't. You really don't. There are so many books. You can get through life without reading Lolita.
Yes.
You can get through life without having reading some of these books. You really don't have to read any novel. Except maybe Moby Dick.
I'm stunned hearing you say that. I mean, I'm a fan of Moby Dick, but I can't believe that there are people in this world who think that you can't get through life without reading Moby Dick.
I'm sure the people think so. I'm just saying. I was drawing for a novel. But this is, actually, you can't get away without reading Moby Dick. But make sure you read Betty to Serena.
Wow. I wonder what I would say. What can you get away with? What can't you get away with not reading?
Ah, God, I'm trying to think.
Huh, that's a question for another.
I honestly do think you to qualify as a reader, you have to have read Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. I think to qualify as there is some novel. It's still, you know, I do think there's a crucial part of the literary experience you miss out on if you do not read Huckleberry Finn.
See, I never liked Huckleberry Finn. I always liked Tom Sawyer better.
Oh my God. You know, it's funny. I keep coming up with this list of underrated novels, and Tom Sawyer is always at the top of the list.
I would agree with you. I would agree with you. I mean,
I'm not taking a retract to anything I just said about Huck Finn, but because we're all over the place, I think people forget how nimble that novel is.
I completely agree. I completely agree. It's a real sort of sense of what the time was, and I understand that, you know, Huck Finn is in some ways more nuanced by being more obvious. But the thing about Tom Sawyer that I found fascinating, it was nothing that I had, maybe it was just when I read it, I had read nothing like it before, and it felt both fresh and American. It sounds like I'm selling cheese, but in other words, I liked it more than I liked Huck Finn, because I could sort of see where Huck Finn was going and I didn't see where Tom Sawyer was going.
You think Huck Finn was trying too hard to announce that this is the serious novel?
I do.
Because I wonder what some books, I'm trying to think of other books where you get that. The writer is like, I'm writing a capital N novel.
Exactly. This is very important.
You know, but, you know, I mean, to sort of, you know, bring back the whole idea of, you know, it's, you know, there are also, you know, terrible writers who've written books.
Absolutely. I mean, I really like Kurt Vonnegut, say. Slapstick, not so much. You know, it's a bad book about twins who try to cure human loneliness, not Slaughterhouse-Five. Not, and my favorite book of his is Welcome to the Monkey House.
Really? I haven't read a lot of him, but I always heard that the primo Vonnegut was player piano.
Absolutely. I'm not saying it's not very excellent. The thing about Welcome to the Monkey House, it's a bunch of stories. It's a story collection, Marlon. So the thing about it is, we were talking about nimble a minute ago. It feels very nimble to me. And a player piano, I think, is terrific. Mm-hmm. Slaughterhouse-Five, of course. And there are a lot of other, you know, enjoyable Vonnegut but Slapstick, I'm like, you know, I understand the attempt, but put the pencil down, go on to the next page.
Yeah. I think it's fine if you feel you can transcend the sort of unsavoriness of the writer and read their book. I think that's absolutely fine. I mean, knock yourselves out. But I also think it's perfectly fine saying ethically, I can't read that person. I think it's perfectly fine saying, in the court of my mind, that book cannot stand. And there's always another book. It's like, you don't want to read Hemingway, read Gene Stafford's The Mountain Lion. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always another book. I think it's because of who we are, I think it's still a very messy business of who you're going to read and who you're not going to read. But we do that every day. Everybody I know who's a reader has a book pile. Right. We're never going to finish it. Some process went through that. But to come back to the point I was saying is the sort of blank. I challenge the. I still think the idea that these books from these shitty people are unimpeachable. I'm like, you sure about that? You sure when we start to get into the nitty gritty, we don't see where you know some of the choices they're making. You know, I mean, I don't want to put words in Flannery O'Connor's mouth because I'm sure her scholars are going to come after us. But the idea that these writers, these people, didn't have opportunities to be better or more open or more intelligent about these things is kind of bullshit. It's like what I get all the time, every person of color gets this all the time, that's how they were back then. That was normal for the time. Supporting slavery was normal for the time, which is not true. You know, people always knew this was an aberration. You know, something happened between Othello and Caliban. A lot of dehumanization of the Moors happened between Othello and Caliban. I challenge the defenders of these authors. I'm like, you sure defense is what we need? I think it's interrogation is what we need.
Well, and also the willingness to walk away from somebody that you don't want to read for reasons that are your own.
Mm. I also think there's merit to reading a book. Absolutely. Read it and go, I read this book. I don't think it stands. I think people should read the Turner Diaries. Well, I wish more people did. Because then we'd realize if it became a bigger critical consensus that this book is shit, maybe less people would be reading it.
And I'm pausing here because I don't want to sound like more of an asshole than I probably already do. But the idea of somebody like, Edgar Rice Burroughs, fan of eugenics, writing about, Tarzan and John Carter and Mars and the sort of superiority of the white race or whatever. Do people, I would assume that most people who are reading this are reading it for, not for the cultural critique, more for the adventure.
Yeah, but that raises a question, though. What is, and this is, to me, sometimes the ultimate clapback to people who defend these books. What is wrong with evolving beyond a book? There are tons of books we no longer read anymore, mostly because we have, quite frankly, evolved beyond them. You can still read them in a certain context, but we've also kind of evolved beyond them. Maybe what's wrong with saying we no longer read Tarzan because we're smarter now. We've evolved beyond that now. Now we expect everybody to have a three-dimensional view of different people. It's not a matter of being politically correct. It's not a matter of canceling Burroughs. The type of science that's written when the world was considered flat is not going to be the type of science that's written when the world is considered round. Does that mean we should still read Science of Flat Earth? No.
Well, that's the thing. If you choose to, I guess my question is, I think you're absolutely right, but if you choose to read this, understand that what he says or she says or the views that these authors have, we have moved on. We have evolved. We have clarified our points of view or whatever going forward, so that maybe you don't want to accept everything that this person wrote as true, as gospel, whatever reason you're reading it. You know, if I'm going to pick up Gone with the Wind, to use an example again, it was written by a woman in the South in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
which is not the world in 2021 or going on. So it's a very much a moment in time that and that you have to understand more than that Scarlett O'Hara was, you know, a plantation girl at heart and really wanted to hold on to her land because land was the only thing that matters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more complicated. The story they're telling is a lot more complicated than that, but there are people, you can take that away from a book like that. And I'm not sure in the vast scheme of things, that's the best use of anybody's time in going nowadays.
Yeah. I'm going to pick up my Edward Said, and then I'm going to go read your book again and go, you know, this is why I shouldn't have read that stupid book. Somebody, and there will be millions of comments. My first one thinking that we have a millions of listeners. But there'll be millions of comments where people are talking about, what about this book? What about that book? We found about this guy. We found about that guy. And I think that's ultimately missing the point. I think the point for me is don't get in the way of my ethical decision of who and who not to read. I wouldn't tell people don't read Flannery O'Connor. I actually hope they do. What I would hope is that people start to broaden the whole idea of what reading is.
Okay.
You know, it's not just plot summary. It's you know, books are worth fighting for, but they're worth fighting mm-hmm. over too. And realize that also the idea that we can't evolve out of a book is ignoring that we are already doing so. We have tons of Victorian novels that we're still reading, which probably means 60% of them are out of print, and we don't even know about them anymore.
I'm sure it's more than 60. Absolutely. I guess the other thing I would say to that is the people who are deciding what you read. When I'm a 12-year-old kid or whatever, the stories, the books that people are telling me to read, or the Western canon that you and I grew up with,
mm-hmm.
you had a better background because you had read Herodotus than I did, maybe. Mm-hmm. Be willing to sort of look at those people you highlight, focus, point at, teach, to sort of say there are other ways of talking about, you know, these ideas or whatever. I mean, I think I'm a better critic or a better reader of Flannery O'Connor now than I was when I first started to read her.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm not interested in giving somebody a complex over loving Enid Blyton.
Why not?
Unless people are absolutely, you know, they it's like, don't take my childhood away. Right. But I'm not trying to take your childhood away. But I also think, you know, that recognize the huge failures in these books. It's fine liking right. a book that's a failure. It's fine. You know, would you want, you know, do I want black children to read Blyton? No. And I think also it's a statement even to your own evolution that you realize that these books no longer, there's nothing more I can learn from these books other than the context in which, you know, not to do or what not to such and such. And maybe there is, you know, there is a place for that. Again, as I was saying, it's a story of my life, reading books by books or authors of worlds and so on that I'm sort of, you know, locked out of. But I also think, for me, as I said in the middle of this broadcast, the only way I came to terms with the idea of reading quote-unquote problematic people was saying, what I'm not giving you is my crisis over it. If I want to reread O'Connor, I'll reread her. If I never read her again for the rest of my life, I don't care. All right, guys, so that is it. We're out of time, and I'm going to wrap this up really quickly, but thanks for listening, and we want to hear back from you. So send your feedback and ideas at wereaddeadpeople@prh.com. That's wereaddeadpeople@prh.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, and why would you not, you know, we hope you'll subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, don't forget to rate this podcast so you can listen to my wildly ridiculous comments and Jake trying to rein me in. And if you don't want to do that, definitely follow us. Follow Riverhead Books on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for updates on all things books all of them written by living authors, of course. And if you're interested, we'll have links in the show notes to the books that we've talked about today. And we talked about a lot of books today. So thanks for listening, and go read The Dead People, because last time I checked, they're still dead.
Listening to Marlon and Jake means my to-read list gets longer every week. Enter Libro FM. Libro FM lets me purchase audiobooks directly from my favorite local bookstore. I can pick from more than 185,000 titles, including bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers. I get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But I'm part of a different story. One that supports community. And you can be too. Marlon and Jake Read Dead People listeners can get a special offer. 2 audiobooks for the price of 1 with your first month of membership. That's 2 audiobooks for just $14.99 with the code Marlon and Jake. Visit Libro.fm to get started. Now go read some Dead People. Offer only valid for new members in Canada and the US.